the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to be talking today about a very interesting topic that's of more than passing interest. It's a matter of current legislative debate and controversy in several states. You have controversy over the school curriculum issue in the state of Texas, and that, of course, reaches far beyond the state of Texas and to other states as well because of the size of the Texas school textbook market and what that means for at least 48 of the other states. And yet it's also a controversy going on in places like Kentucky and elsewhere, Louisiana, where there are state legislatures and school boards who are discussing the idea of requiring schools and school teachers to, quote, teach the controversy. And in particular with reference to two topics, to evolution and to the issue of climate change. Charles C. Haynes, writing in his capacity as senior scholar at the First Amendment Center in Washington, D.C., sounds an alarm about this. I write about it today at my website at albertmohler.com, an article that is entitled Scientists Have Worldviews Too. It's both wrong and dangerous to think they do not. You can find my article just by going to albertmohler.com. We'll be talking about it today because let me tell you why I find a real interest in this. Charles C. Haynes is a very interesting fellow, a very keen observer of things related to public policy in America, particularly where the First Amendment is at stake. And he writes this article. It's published at the website for the First Amendment Center. It's also published in several newspapers around the country. But he makes the argument that we should just leave it to the scientists to decide what science is. And if you read my article, you'll see it full bore. But he says that these bills contemplated in some of these state legislatures to require schools to, quote, teach the controversy when it comes to evolution and global warming or climate change, he says they're really not about academic freedom. They're really driven by politics and religion. Now, this is what he says. Listen to his argument. He says, genuine academic freedom means exposing students to how scientists determine what is and isn't controversial in science, and then helping students understand how the scientific method is used to resolve unanswered questions about any and all scientific theories. Scientists and science educators, he writes, should decide what our kids need to learn about science, not legislators or religious advocacy groups, end quote. He goes on and writes, proponents of legislation to teach all sides claim that there are indeed scientific alternatives to the prevailing scientific theories on such topics as evolution and global warming. If that claim is true, then these alternatives must be peer-reviewed in science journals before being presented as science in public schools. He says the place where we should not be having these debates over science is in the public schools. Rather, we should let scientists determine those debates. Well, I write at my website today an article that, again, is entitled Scientists Have Worldviews Too, because the point I want to make is this. There is no such thing as neutral science. There is no such thing as science that is not tied to ideological conflict and political concerns. Science is largely funded by the government. That means it's political. Science is largely regulated by the world of higher academia. Trust me, that's ideological. And so the idea that scientists just somehow live in a rarefied world where there's this mode of knowledge called science that just determines what science is, well, we have a major problem with that. And, you know, science is an artifact of the culture. Science is a part of the culture and society around us. Scientists are real live human beings who have ideologies and politics and worldviews too. And whenever you put them together, just like you put any other group together, you're going to have the very same issues you have elsewhere. Science is not as monolithic as many scientists would like to claim. And a lot of what's going on, especially when it comes to evolution and when it comes to climate change, is explicitly, ideological and political. There's just no doubt about it. And by the way, there are commercial interests here as well. That is to say, there's big money to be made or not made, or made in one place or by one people or by others, depending on how the science is framed and understood. You know, you could expand this particular discussion to history or any number of other issues in the school curriculum. But in a democracy, I'm going to argue that there's the recognition that the schools really are one of the inevitable places where these conflicts are going to happen. And I do not think it's fair to suggest that we just let scientists determine what science is. Well, which scientists? Very, very interesting discussion. I want you to join it by calling me at 877-893-8255. Do you think parents should just stay out of this? Should parents and citizens just stay out and let the scientists and trained professionals, if you put it that way, determine what it is? I'd really like to know. I'd really like to know, and I think some of your legislatures would too, and I think, furthermore, a lot of the school boards, and not only in your area but around the country, are going to be dealing with this very same issue. You know, I'll tell you what's really going on here, and when we come back in just a moment, we're going to be talking about this in a more intense way, but I can tell you what's going on here. The scientific establishment, just to name an establishment, is incredibly frustrated that the public won't get out of the way of these discussions. And when it comes to the public schools, citizens in general, but parents in particular, just seem to have a real vested interest in what their children are taught. I wonder why. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We'll be getting to that in just a few moments. And let's remember, one of the things we have to think about continuously as Christians is the fact that there are worldview implications at stake, and we'll be talking about those implications. Just a couple of other things in the news I want you to know about. A very interesting article in the New York Times about Dr. Howard W. Jones, Jr. He is the physician who, just a few decades ago, led to the first test tube baby born in the United States. I did not know, by the way, until this profile was published in the New York Times, that prior to that, he had been doing sex change surgeries. But what's really interesting is that this particular medical doctor is now 99 years old, and he's still busy. He's not still busy in the laboratory, but he's still busy thinking and reflecting on this. You look at this particular article, and you realize you don't have to go back very far until it's clear that human beings didn't know a great deal about even the process of birth and fertilization. Reading here from the article written by Randy Hutter Epstein, I read, Dr. Jones said that while he did not realize it at the time, this is back now several decades ago, he now believes that he and Dr. Edwards created a fertilized human oocyte in a Johns Hopkins laboratory in 1965. No one had done that before. You know, they weren't even able really to determine back in 1965, whether the egg was fertilized or not until there was cellular division. They didn't have the kind of electron microscopy that we have now that enables people to see. You know, folks, this is just a reminder to me, even as this doctor is 99 years old, that these big issues of the reproductive revolution are still among us. The most pressing questions I often get to the website, as you and other listeners and readers write back, is are questions that are directly related to this. And we're going to be focusing some upcoming programs on discussing anew the issues of test tube babies, contraception, and surrogacy. Because, interesting question, I had a pastor of a major church call me the other day, wonderful, faithful, evangelical pastor, and just say, you know, I've got a church member who says that as a gift, she would like to become a surrogate mother for a couple. Is that a problem? Well, that's something we're really going to have to think about. That's something we need to talk about. We'll be doing that in an upcoming program. Folks, every once in a while, I just want parents to know something I just think you need to know, and I want to mark your card and let you know about this. The New York Times also has a very interesting article by Brooks Barnes out indicating that many of you may not know that your children and teenagers may be seeing trailers of movies, those trailers containing inappropriate material for children and teenagers, in particular profanity, nudity, and other material. They would not be allowed to see these if they were in the theater. In other words, these would be required to carry an NC-17 or an R rating, something that you know, parents would be able to at least regulate. But where are they seeing them then? They're seeing them on the web, on the World Wide Web. They are known as red band trailers. Reading here from the report, while most of these trailers are approved for broad audiences, the red band variety typically features profanity, nudity, or other material deemed inappropriate for children. You're supposed to be 17 or older to watch an R-rated trailer, and most theaters refuse to run them, but the web has proved extremely hospitable to them despite a difficult-to-enforce industry rule that restricts their release to sites that use age verification tests. Now, see, that's the issue. That's what caught my attention here. It turns out that many of these sites use an age verification test they know is meaningless. And so while you're thinking your children might be protected from seeing these things, this is just a little heads up to you. If your kids are hooked up to the internet and you're not monitoring what they're doing pretty much 24/7, then they could be watching these things. All they have to do is click and just say, yes, I'm 18. Nothing else is really required. And the website's able to say that that represents verification. Very, very interesting stuff out there. There always is. It seems like every time we turn around, there's something new that is coming up in terms of, big issues for us to consider. In terms of big issues, let me tell you, the court challenges to the Obamacare health care legislation recently adopted by the House and the Senate, signed into law by President Obama, is taking on a very interesting new turn yesterday in USA Today. Jonathan Turley, a well-known legal expert at George Washington University, is discussing what he considers to be the biggest constitutional issue there, which is the individual mandate. If you haven't seen that article, you ought to see it at USA Today. We'll put a link up to it today at the program. Just a reminder that sometimes legislation comes with not only unexpected consequences, but unexpected complications. This one was evidently really not foreseen. Jonathan Turley is no insignificant legal scholar. It'll be interesting to see what happens from this in days ahead. We'll be watching it with you. We're going to come right back to talk about whether or not parents have any right to suggest that schools ought to teach the controversy. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. My article published today at my website at albertmueller.com gets right to the issue, and that is that scientists have worldviews too. Let me tell you what's really going on here. It's a public debate, pretty significant public debate, because it reaches into state legislatures and school boards and all the rest, about what schools should teach. My particular focus on this was prompted by a column by Charles C. Haynes, who is senior scholar at the First Amendment Center in Washington, D.C., he writes an article entitled "When Religion Trumps Science," and his argument is that we should basically get out of the way and let scientists determine what science is. In fact, he says scientists and science educators should decide what our kids need to learn about science, not legislators or religious advocacy groups. And you could add to that parents, because that's basically the fuel behind the legislators and what he's describing here is religious advocacy groups. You know, the background of this is the current call to teach the controversy. And by the way, where in the world did conservatives come up with that title? Well, they got it from liberals, because liberals have been talking about this for a long time. The mantra in higher education, colleges and universities, on the campuses used to be, teach the controversy. Whether it's war and peace or you name the issue, politics, economics, you know, teach the controversy. And that became one of the great themes of higher education in the 60s and 70s and the 80s. Now conservatives are saying, well, you know, if the theme is teach the controversy, then why aren't we doing that when it comes to controversy over evolutionary theory and over climate change? Now, of course, the scientific establishment, and let's just talk about the fact that there is an establishment, it responds with outrage at anyone's suggestion that science and science educators should be told what the schools are and are not going to teach, and what is and is not science. Charles C. Haynes is a very reasonable person. He generally, in articles like this, brings a very sound kind of rational, moderate approach to these things. And I'm sure when he wrote this article, he was absolutely certain that he's presenting what is the common sense approach. But I don't think it is, and I understand why he thinks it is, but I don't think it is, and I'll tell you why. It's because he assumes, in this article, that there is a body of knowledge and a body of knowers known as science and scientists, and they, free of all ideological and political constraints, will decide what science is, and then they'll tell the rest of us. And we'll put that in our school textbooks, and we'll make that a matter of our school curriculum. Okay, I don't believe that exists. I don't believe that rarefied a world of supposedly objective politics and ideology-free science exists, because it doesn't exist anywhere. Scientists have worldviews too, and scientists are largely funded by the government. Government funding is one of the biggest issues when it comes to science, and I guarantee you where there's government funding, there's politics. And when it comes to ideology, for crying out loud, most science takes place in the rarefied world of the modern research university, which is faculty dominated and ideological from top to bottom. And, when it comes to something such as evolutionary theory, what we're talking about there is an entire worldview. And by the way, it's a worldview that goes far beyond observational science. No doubt about it. And the same thing when it comes to climate change. And you see, what you have in the public debate is often a juxtaposition between smart scientists and stupid parents. That's the way it's presented. Or illiterate, scientifically backward citizens. The reality is that the scientific establishment has not won the debate in the larger culture on the issue of evolution, and that's driving a lot of them crazy, and neither have they won the debate on climate change. Now, that's not to say there's no scientific basis for evidence of climate change. That's not to say that we're arguing that human beings have nothing to do with climate change. It is to say that there is a controversy there. One of the interesting things, by the way, that appears in Charles Haines' article is where he talks about scientists determining what science is and is not. Let me read to you from a paragraph in his column. He writes, "Proponents of legislation to teach all sides claim that there are indeed scientific alternatives to the prevailing scientific theories on such topics as evolution and global warming. If that claim is true, then those alternatives must be peer-reviewed in science journals before being presented as science in public schools." End quote. Okay, folks, there is the crux of the matter. In other words, scientists, through their own scientific system of peer review, will determine what is and is not legitimate science. Let me tell you why, in just recent days, that argument falls so flat on its face. It is because, for instance, with the leaked emails coming from a university in Great Britain, we now know that a great deal of the climate science that has been presented was presented by scientists who were involved in an intentional effort to keep alternative views out of peer-reviewed journals. And they are now horribly embarrassed by the release of their data, which is calling the entire enterprise into question. That just gets to the point that the peers who are doing the peer reviewing are also people who have worldviews and are committed ideologically and often complicated politically. This is not a slam, shut issue in which we just say, look, we know that this is where any scientist or scientific institution is going to land on the issue. This is not an issue in which I'm going to doubt that there is a scientific establishment, on the other hand, that does have a prevailing consensus. But the reality is that when it comes to what's going to be taught to our children in the schools, legislators do have to have an interest in this. If they didn't have a personal interest, I guarantee you they have an interest in their reelection, and they know parents and citizens have an interest in this. And, is there junk science out there? You bet. Is there junk history out there? Oh, you bet. Is there junk of all kinds of curricular manifestations and dimensions out there? You bet. But you're going to have to win the public argument. That's what democracy is all about. That's why we have legislatures. That's why we have school boards. And that's why we elect citizens to those boards and legislatures and to Congress and, for that matter, elsewhere. And that's why they are accountable to the people. So if you want to win the argument, you're going to have to win a public argument. The phone number to join this discussion is 877-893-8255. I want to know from you as parents, do you want the schools, the public schools in particular, to teach the controversy? Or do you want to just allow scientists to tell us what science is? Do you have any concerns about this whole idea that somehow science is this rarefied world in which there's no ideology and no political complications? You know, that would worry me. I would be very worried if American citizens thought of science as nothing more than the unfettered, laboratory, sanitized exercise of a certain method of knowledge. Now, let's be thankful for that. Let's be thankful that there is indeed a scientific method. I wouldn't be talking to you, having this conversation. We wouldn't have these airwaves. We wouldn't have the technology just in terms of medical treatments. Let me tell you how thankful I am for modern science and modern medicine. I'm thankful for the NASA space, exploration, endeavors. I'm very thankful for the NASA, effort that led to putting a man on the moon and returning him safely. That's one of the wonders of modern science. By the way, that's also a reminder to us that government is very highly involved in this. And at its very best, you can point to government involvement in science and peer-reviewed science and say that the NASA moon missions represent the very best, but at the same time, you'd have to go back and say, well, then the Nazi medical experiments represent the dark side there. Oh, that was a scientific consensus as well. But I don't think there's anyone who believes, with the memory of the Nazi medical experiments in the background, that science should not be accountable to the larger society, and that's what we're talking about here. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Folks, you have an interest in this. If you've got kids, grandkids, frankly, if you've got any interest in the future of the American society, you've got a vested interest in this. What would you say to someone who says, just let the scientists determine what science is, and all the rest of you just get out of the way? Write me at mail@albertmoeller.com, Facebook/The Albert Moeller Program, Twitter, Albert Moeller, and the phone number, 877-893-TALK. That's 877-893-8255. And I'm Albert Moeller.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Am I thankful for modern science? You bet. For much of it, again, I don't think I'd be alive today, but for modern medical science, I'm thankful for modern technology, modern scientific invention. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this conversation, much less all that we can do by communicating over the World Wide Web and all the rest. But at the same time, I am aware that there's no such thing as a non-ideological science, and there's no such thing as a non-ideological scientist. Scientists have worldviews, too. That's why I wrote the article I published today at albertmohler.com, and that's why I felt like I had to answer the argument of Charles C. Haynes, who was senior scholar of the First Amendment Center, when he says that religion should not trump science, and in particular that folks should just let the scientists determine what science is. Lots of folks writing in. You can always write us at mail at albertmohler.com, at Facebook, the Albert Mohler Program. Glad to hear from you. Lance wrote in to say, whenever I raise this objection to my skeptical friends, they often retort with the refrain that scientists are willing to change their minds based on new evidence, whereas religious people are rigidly committed to age-old beliefs and are unwilling to consider evidence that contradicts Scripture. All right, Lance, let's take that apart for just a moment. What this assumes is that scientists go in with no fixed beliefs, and they're just willing to look at the evidence and decide, well, that's what the evidence demonstrates. Thus, I'm going to have to change my mind and follow the evidence trail. Well, that's kind of a romanticized but very familiar and common understanding of science. But let me tell you the problem with that. It assumes that scientists come into the equation with no particular preference as to which direction the theory or the data may point, and yet a theoretical willingness to be open to anything. Or they may come in with previous conceptions they're quite willing to have corrected by the data. Now, the myth of this, the kind of parable everyone has in mind is a scientist who goes in, has one of those aha moments and says, I was wrong, I'm going to have to rethink everything. I'm sure that's happened. I'm sure that that in the background to our knowledge today are things we learned by precisely that kind of thing happening. But that is not in the main the way science has worked. You have insights from people like Thomas Kuhn, historian and philosopher of science, who've demonstrated again that worldview always factors into this. Let me just give you an example. People think of Charles Darwin as going to the Galapagos Islands and all of a sudden looking at animals and by naturalistic means coming to the conclusion that there must have been a process of evolution. That is simply wrong. Charles Darwin believed in evolution before he ever got on the boat. Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was a believer in evolution. Evolution was a common thought. It was a thought or a theory in search of evidence, and it's the evidence that Charles Darwin went looking for. And it's just a reminder of the fact that often we have a romanticized view of science that just isn't so. Now, when it comes to Lance's question here, about, let's just say, the people described as religious people, rigidly committed to age-old beliefs. Well, you know, we're all committed to beliefs. But the question is, what can trump our beliefs? What can require us to change our minds? And I'll tell you right now, the Scripture often changes my mind. I think that I knew something, and then Scripture comes and tells me, no, you don't know that, you know this. But that's a clear belief in biblical authority. If you don't believe in biblical authority, then you're going to have some other authority. And some other authority is going to be the relative authority, for instance, of modern science, whatever that may be. And by the way, if you're going to tie your ultimate authority in life to modern science, you're going to have to be changing all kinds of theories all the time. And quite frankly, on many things, there's no consensus at all. So I just want to give you some encouragement, Lance. You're not in a weak position here in terms of knowledge by admitting right up front that you have a pre-commitment to divine revelation. You just need to be very honest about that and upfront about that. And you have every right to enter into public conversation and debate about that. When it comes to evolutionary theory in particular, that's a part of what really drives much of the scientific establishment and the intellectual elites nuts. But the reality is they haven't won the argument. And they're not winning the argument, not with the vast majority of the American people. Andy wrote in to say he, too, wants to affirm that everyone has a worldview, says that he's working with this through his Awana Journey program with youth, studying this very, very much in the present. And, you know, worldview matters more than we even understand it while we're thinking about it. Because even while we're thinking about how a worldview matters, our worldview is is in operation even then. Every single human being has certain intellectual commitments that are prior to our ability even to think about anything else. There are certain assumptions we all hold that make the world make sense to us. And there is no one who goes into a scientific laboratory or a classroom or a church building or, for that matter, a phone booth. How's that for an anachronistic, out-of-date illustration? You can't go into a closet without certain pre-commitments of an intellectual nature that, for shorthand, we're just going to call worldview. Just try it. It won't work whether you're a scientist or a non-scientist. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Love to hear from you. We'll be right back with more on the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Are you willing to let scientists and scientists alone, along with science educators, decide what is and is not science and is not to be presented to school children? Or do you think that parents and other citizens and legislators ought to have a say in this? The argument behind the hands-off gets down to the assumption that science is an unfettered, ideologically pure, non-political realm of knowledge. And I'm just going to suggest that that's not true. It's not plausible and shouldn't be argued with a straight face because it isn't anything of the sort. Now, that's not to say that modern science doesn't have certain rules of knowledge, doesn't have certain guidelines and certain definitional issues. That's very important. It is indeed a growing and expanding body of knowledge, but there are ideological conflicts through the center of science. There are political issues pervasive through modern science. And when it comes to what's going to be taught to school children, there's no way you can get around that. And when it comes to what is and is not science? Do we want our kids being taught junk science, what patently is not true? No. But quite frankly, what we're talking about here is not an open and shut case like that. What we're talking about here when it comes to evolution and climate change is a contested science and uncontested evidence. And that's where, you know, as an ardent opponent of evolution, if the evolutionists were to ask me for advice, hard to imagine that. The advice I would give them is this. You're going to have to win the argument. You're not going to be able just to bring the supposed majesty of modern science and say to people, you must accept this because it isn't working. It won't work, and for good reason. Now, let me tell you where it does work, and this is what's really interesting. Let me tell you where it does work. It works where you live in a highly secularized world. So if you go in many European countries or you go even north, for instance, into Canada, you're not going to find so much opposition to evolution or opposition to climate change because the worldview, there's that word again, the worldview held by most of the people who are the residents there, well, that worldview is very similar to that of the intellectual elites and thus that very liberal, progressive, largely secular worldview pertains with very little controversy. But what's interesting is that it isn't lasting even there. If you follow the European headlines, you will know that that there are many people asking some very basic questions about both climate change and about evolution. And, well, interesting headlines coming out of Europe about Muslims and the rise of anti-evolutionary pressure coming from Muslim immigrant communities. You know, here in the United States of America, many people are not aware of the fact it's not just conservative Christians, Bible-believing Christians who have opposition to evolution. The reality is that it is a wide-scale, very broad movement of rejection. And for that reason, it drives the intellectual elites to perplexity. You know, I was in a public debate at Columbia University, I guess now 3 or 4 years ago, one of the persons who was very clear about opposition to the theory of evolution was an Orthodox Jewish attorney. It's not just conservative Christians, but it is tied to a biblical worldview, no doubt about it. And so what you have here in the approach taken by many And I don't want to just generalize the argument made by Charles C. Haynes. You can read his article, his column for yourself. You can go to my website at albertmuller.com, find my article, Scientists Have Worldviews Too. And you can follow there all the way to his article, both as published at the First Amendment Center and in the Courier Journal here in Louisville, Kentucky. But it is very interesting when you look at this, you realize that there are people who genuinely believe this is an open and shut case, that this is nothing more than the chatter, a nuisance chatter coming from parents and religious advocacy groups and their pandering legislators. I just think there's a whole lot more to that. Let's go to Daniel calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. What are you thinking, Daniel?
Let you comment. I just wanted to say that I think the main battle is at home and what we're teaching our kids before they even get into school. You know, I think a lot of Christian parents, and I did it for a long time, just totally think of the Bible and science as two totally separate things. So we never teach our kids or ever talk to them about science. We just let school handle it. So I would just encourage parents to, you know, do a little research of their own if they haven't already and make sure that we take care of it before some teacher that we don't know does, I guess, is all.
Yeah, I think that's an extremely wise comment, Daniel. And by the way, it's wise at several levels. And I have to tell you, the most heartening thing about what you said is that parents need to be involved in this, and not just by saying, here's what I prefer, here's what I do not prefer, but by actually engaging in the lives of their children in this, and not only before they go to school, but frankly, while they are in school as well, no matter what kind of school they may be enrolled in. And by the way, one footnote to this is, of course, as the public, we have an interest in the public schools, even if our children are not in the public schools. Because the shaping of the worldview of the rising generation is of concern to us, not only first and foremost, of course, for our own children, but for other children as well. Daniel raised another very interesting point when he said, you know, we really need to understand that we as Christian parents aren't just supposed to teach the Bible to our children and then leave, say, the other disciplines, the other subjects to the schools. You know, from a Christian worldview perspective, they're all woven together. All of these disciplines are accountable to Christ. It is the Christian parent's responsibility to think all these things through and to be able to help the child connect the dots between Christian truth and the application of that truth to every realm of knowledge. And that requires a very attentive, very active, growingly intelligent parent. But then again, that's the task we're called to, and it ought to be an exhilarating task. And getting to know these things should be a matter of joy as well as of challenge, because after all, the Lord has given us minds with which to think about these things and come to an understanding of these things. And indeed, a mind that is indeed reflecting of the fact that God made us as creatures who are dependent upon worldviews, and every single one of us has one. You know, the task is not just to confront the controversy or to teach the controversies. When it comes to schools, whether it's at the collegiate and university level or at the, for that matter, the preschool or the elementary school level, it is to be engaged in these issues in the most intelligent way at every point in the society and at every opportunity. And to remember the fundamental issue of worldview wherever we are and wherever we show up with an argument, because it's another reminder to us that we're not just arguing point to point, argument to argument. What we often have is a clash of the most fundamental assumptions. And when it happens, we better know that's what's happening. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Good discussion today. You can find my article on the fact that scientists have worldviews too at Albert Mueller, that's MOHLER.com. And if you go to that article, you can also find at the bottom of the page links to the article by Mr. Haynes, Charles C. Haynes of the First Amendment Center, and some other materials as well, including an article from the New York Times, the article that I think prompted Mr. Haynes' article. This is an ongoing conversation, and we'll keep it that way. We're always glad to hear from you. Write us anytime. Just write us at mail@albertmuller.com. And by the way, when you see something going on out there, you see a news story, an event, an issue, you have a burning question, well, send it along to me. And it could well be that it will find its way onto the agenda for either writing or for radio. And I'm indebted to intelligent readers who are kind and generous to send things along to me as well. Folks, all eyes, of course, are on the 3rd with the release of Apple's iPad. Just a reminder to us of the increasing place of technology in our lives. Have you noticed all the hype and excitement about this? I asked the question in a Twitter post I put up earlier today. What are Americans more excited about? What are they more focused on right now, this weekend, the release of the iPad or the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, the raising of Jesus Christ from the dead? Well, the reality is that amidst all the hype and expectation, the iPad is garnering a great deal of attention. Interesting questions being asked. Will it change your life? Well, you know, if it does, your life undoubtedly will be changed in other ways as well. But let's not underestimate what technology is and how technology operates. It insinuates itself into our lives. And the reality is that given the way most of us now live, given the fact that we are living in an increasingly digital world, given the fact that that pretty much 24/7 digital communication is becoming more and more the norm, well, my guess is that the future of pad computing is just a reminder to us that pretty soon we and our computers will be melded a great deal. Not only will they be with us, if not on us, they're going to be accessible and connected to us a great deal of the time. You know, finding how to unhook from all this is a great, great challenge. And right now there are a lot of people who just can't wait to get the iPad in their hands until they can do more. The reality is, of course, with every successive jump in the technology, you know, well, we're not redefining human life. We're not redefining the human being. But we are changing the way we live, the way we communicate with each other. And I'll tell you, one of the interesting things that has come out of this with the iPad coming out this weekend is kind of a haunting reminder that I read just this morning. You know, when was the last time you sat in an audience and listened or watched something? When was the last time you heard music performed and you were sitting in an audience? The release of the iPad is another reminder to us, kind of a parable of the age, that increasingly it's all coming down to an audience of one. Well, thanks for being in the listening audience of this program today. We'll be back next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation, back tomorrow for a special Good Friday edition of the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.